Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Human rights defenders were disappointed when the U.S. administration approved a $650 million air-to-air missile sale to the Royal Saudi Air Force and a $500 million support services contract for Saudi military helicopters. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Brett Wilkins, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Human Rights Watch to U.S. Stop Selling Weapons to Saudis. Here's the story. As U.S. President Joe Biden met with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman recently, a top official at Human Rights Watch implored the American leader to not lift the ban on the sale of certain weapons to the repressive monarchy as it continues waging an atrocity-laden war in Yemen. Responding to reports that the Biden administration is considering ending its vague proscription against the transfer of offensive weaponry to Saudi Arabia, Michael Page, Human Rights Watch's West Asia-North Africa region deputy director, warned that such a policy reversal could lead to fresh rights violations in Yemen. Since the beginning of the war in 2015, Human Rights Watch and other groups have documented how the Saudi-led United Arab Emirates-led coalition has used U.S. weapons in apparent unlawful airstrikes, including apparent war crimes, wrote Page, adding, the U.S. government's own report has detailed oversight failures on these sales. More than 300,000 Yemenis have died during the 7-year war, 150,000 of them as a direct result of military action, according to the Armed Conflict Location and Event Data Project, ACLED. A Saudi-led blockade of Yemen has exacerbated starvation and disease in the war-torn nation of 30 million inhabitants. Human Rights Watch has called for the suspension of all sales, both offensive and defensive, to Saudi Arabia and the UAE, said Page, adding, renewing U.S. offensive weapons sales to Saudi Arabia would further undermine Biden's promise to prioritize human rights in U.S. relations with the country. Shortly after taking office, Biden, who while campaigning for president, vowed to make Saudi Arabia a pariah over the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, the journalist, and other human rights crimes, imposed a temporary freeze on arms sales on the country and coalition partner UAE. Human rights defenders were subsequently disappointed when the Biden administration approved a $650 million air-to-air missile sale to the Royal Saudi Air Force and a $500 million support services contract for the Saudi military helicopters. Recently, the U.S. House of Representatives approved an amendment to the $839 billion National Defense Authorization Act that limits U.S. weapons transfers to nations and armed forces implicated in human rights crimes. Also recently, Senators Bernie Sanders, Patrick Leahy, and Elizabeth Warren introduced a resolution to end U.S. involvement in the Saudi-led U.S.-supported war on Yemen, which Sanders called unauthorized and unconstitutional. This war has created the world's worst humanitarian crisis today, Sanders added, and it is past time to end U.S. complicity in those horrors.
Being the second largest country in the Middle East, Iran is rich with a colorful bouquet of architectural masterpieces, magnificent mosques, ancient caravanserais, impressive rock tombs, and former royal cities of the ancient Persian Empire. But perhaps Iran's amazing desert landscape has been largely overlooked. I'm Zarin Shajeri, and this is Aperture. Iran's deserts are unique in the variety of their composition and surface types. A yardang, or kalut, as they're called in Farsi, is a topographical feature that has been carved out of a surface by the wind. They're most commonly found in deserts where there is a sand supply, which abrades the surface when moved by the wind, and soft sedimentary rocks that the sand easily erodes. Over time, the sand wears down the surface into beautiful streamlined shapes that are aligned with the prevailing sand-moving winds. Iran is famous for mega yardangs in Kerman in the south of the country. Stay with us for this episode of Iran Trotter as we follow Javad to discover the spectacular kaluts in Iran.
To most humans, nature means trees, jungles, rivers, and mountains. But is that all there is to this beautiful nature created by the architect of all beauties? God is limitless. He is infinite and has created nature with infinite beauties. Nature has many and varied complicated aspects, and the natural world in Iran is no exception. Many people do not consider deserts and wastelands as part of nature. But the fact is, deserts constitute a large part of the environment on our planet. All we have to do is open our eyes and look at these countless, peerless beauties. Hi, I'm Javad Gharai. I'm an Iran trotter, and I'm traveling to the most pristine areas of my beloved country and uncovering to you its many beauties. This time, I've come to a vast city in Kerman province, a city that in fact forms a major swath of the amazing landscape in Kerman. The fictitious city of Kelutz. I set out on a 110-kilometer walking journey to the northeast of Kerman province to arrive at my main destination. The Yardangs are located in an area spanning 11,000 square kilometers in the west of Iran's Lut Desert. The Yardangs of Lut cover an area around 150 kilometers long and around 70 kilometers wide. In the words of some researchers, this vast expanse used to be the bed of a lake sometime in the third geological period, and that in fact the Yardangs, or the Kaluts, are made up of brittle sediments lying at the bottom of that lake. At some point in the third geological period, the lake dried up as a result of the major climatic changes that occurred on Earth. Torrential rains and their ensuing humidity in the following periods and water erosion led to the creation of the Kaluts, or Yardangs. Other researchers believe the Yardangs are the result of the alluvial deposits originating from Birjan Mountains in the distant past. Sharp temperature fluctuations in the Lut and the constant blowing of local winds carrying abrasive sediment loads of sandstones battering these Yardangs over the years have led to their erosion. Winds that continue to lash out at these Yardangs and eventually raise beautiful clay terraces to the ground. Trips to the heart of deserts and wastelands have always been risky, but studying up on such places and the risks involved in traveling to them, not to mention carrying a proper map, a GPS device, and the topographic map of the area you are traveling to, can bring the number of risks involved down to a great extent. In all fairness, one of the most beautiful areas in the Lut Desert is the Shahdad Yardangs of Kerman. I mean, there are few places in the world with such beautiful desert landscape. I think nowhere in the world can you find a landscape as vast as this one. Here I am in the Lut Yardangs, hoping for a good trip, and I'm positive it's gonna be a thrill. I stepped onto a part of the river that not many people were interested in traveling to for several reasons. The flight distance between the Yardangs and the Yalan Mega Dunes in the west of Lut is around 150 kilometers. For several consecutive years, part of the Yalan Mega Dunes was announced by NASA as one of the hottest spots on Earth. This is an area where temperatures run above 70 degrees in the summer. With no trace of life among them, the Yardangs of Lute look scary to human eyes. Although in recent years, some researchers have discovered and registered a number of plants and insect species in them. But at first look, the fictional town of Kalutz or Yardangs bears no trace of life of any kind. Encountering sandstorms in the desert or getting lost in them, or all the other hidden dangers of such terrains, can put your life at grave risk. But none of those reasons stop me from walking right into the Yardangs. You can enjoy spending time in this beautiful natural landscape with enough information on its climate and terrain, and by using a map and GPS device. No one has found any trace of human habitation in the Kalutz area, not in the past and not in the present eras. But on the outskirts of these beautiful Kalutz, there are many remnants of human habitation from years gone by. The Kalutz are located on the outskirts of Shahdad, a city in Kerman that is among the most ancient in Iran, a place with a more than 6,000-year-old culture and history. The world's oldest metal flag was discovered here. The many kanats and water reservoirs on the outskirts of the Kalutz, as well as the lush gardens of Shahdad, are evidence of human settlement in the distant past. Right at the beginning of the route, I came across an area with a concentration of strange Kalut formations, a place famous for its egg-shaped hills. I have to walk a long distance to get to the heart of the Shahdad Kalutz, but the beautiful elevations you see behind me, which is sort of the prelude to the main Kalutz, are called the egg-shaped hills, and for good reason. They really do look like eggs, although these hills are considered as little Kalutz. The reason they've been abraded more than the other Kalutz in this region is rainfalls and, of course, the type of soil they are made from. And if it goes on like this, rainwater and wind are going to destroy them in the not-too-distant future. Every spot you go to in this region, you see new and different Kalutz or Yardangs. The majority of those who travel to the Kalutz are not aware of the diversity of the landscapes in this terrain and its natural phenomena. But the fact is, the Kalutz of Kerman are a peerless kaleidoscope of beautiful desert landscapes. Everywhere you look in this region, you see spectacular yet peculiar sights. Around 7 kilometers after the egg-shaped hills, I arrived at another strange yet interesting scenery. From a distance, I thought I was approaching some prehistoric cemetery. But, well, this is not a cemetery. These mounds you see here are called the Dolphin Hills. In fact, they are very small kalutz in the vicinity of the big ones. The dual action of wind abrasion and rainwater has chiseled them to look like dolphins swimming on a wave of dust and sand. Every part of the kalutz in Shahdad has its own unique shape. And these Dolphin Hills are among those unique parts of the Shahdad Kalutz. These are really extraordinary, really beautiful.
I've been walking around in the Shahdot Kaluz for hours now, deep into the heart of these remarkable protuberances. Although it is fall now, and the best season to travel to the Lut Desert, and of course to the Shahdot Kaluz, early spring is also a good time. Anyway, it's noontime and very hot. It was very cold in the morning, but now the temperature keeps going up, so I'm going to have to take a layer off. The temperature in the desert fluctuates sharply between the morning and the evening. It's always like that. So you have to remember to pack the right clothes for summer and winter weather. That's what it's like in the desert. You get summer and winter weather at the same time, happening within hours of each other on a single day. You should keep that in mind. It's really getting hot here. I just hope it'll stop right there as we approach noontime. Because, I mean, the heat from the sun can just be unbearable. Although I've already thought of something for a situation like this, one of the most important things we have to carry with us when traveling through deserts and wastelands are glasses, sunglasses that is. They're very important to protecting your eyes against the scorching sun. When the rays of the sun reach the dirt, they are reflected in your direction and bother your eyes. The air here is very clean. That's why there's so much light. So you have to wear sunglasses if you ever come to a place like this. If you don't, your vision is going to get hurt, and you're going to get wrinkles around your eyes. And that's what the ladies are very sensitive about. Dazzling beauties of the Kaluz redoubled my enthusiasm for traveling into the heart of these sand formations. But the deeper I walked into them, the more arduous things became. Walking on the sand in the punishing heat requires strenuous effort and drains your energy. The day started out cold, but the temperatures kept going up as I approached midday. The biting autumn cold was nowhere to be felt. Walking on the sand and grit really wears you out after a while. And it makes you sweat a lot, too. It's starting to get really hot. I'd better change into something more suitable. I'm wearing a thin layer, but the short sleeves expose my forearms to the sun, and that means sunburn. The sun is just bearing down on me. I feel like it's burning my face. I mean, I really had to change my clothes to avoid getting sunburn on my arms. The sun can get really annoying round about noontime out in the desert, even if it's not very hot. You're bound to get sunburned. So you must wear long-sleeve shirts with good breathability at the same time. I mean, that's what I always do. And I've never run into any problems because long sleeves have always protected my arms against the sun. Now, more important than wearing long-sleeve shirts out in the desert is to have proper headgear, such as this hat. What this hat does is it prevents the radiation from the sun from reaching your head to a great extent, and as a result, your face, neck, and ears won't get burnt. It really feels good when you wear one of these. And of course, a good pair of sunglasses is a must-have in a place like this. But there is another type of sunglasses, that I carry with me all the time. These are called storm goggles by some and skiing goggles by others. It's important to pack a pair of these goggles too, because when there is a sandstorm, when strong winds start blowing, they kick up a lot of sand and other particles into the air, and these goggles prevent them from going into your eyes. More important than that, you can see where you're going when you're out in the sticks without worrying about sand getting into your eyes. Man, I'm beat. It really wears you out when you walk on sand and up and down on those little hills. It's just fatiguing. I dare say, walking about in the Kaluz area and the hot areas of Lut Desert in the summer is next to impossible. The temperatures are so high and the surface of the earth so hot, you won't last more than a few kilometers. That's a time when you cannot see any living creatures in the Lut Desert. You can only see them during the night. It's very important to carry enough water when you travel to a place like this. If you're going to spend 2, 3, or 4 days trekking in the desert, make sure you have enough water. That's because you sweat a lot and your body loses a lot of water. And obviously, when that happens, you become dehydrated. In addition to that, you have to eat food that contains salt. But if your food doesn't contain enough salt, you need to eat salty nuts. That's because your body loses a lot of sodium as you sweat in the heat, and that's going to harm your body. Okay, now let's eat an orange. The Kaluts expand intermittently from the west of the Lut Desert towards the southeast. The corridors formed among them look in the same direction as the Kaluts themselves, that is, in the direction of the local winds. They are all very brittle. The shape of each Kalut depends on how it was first formed, its density, and the direction of the winds that brush against it on their paths. Shifting winds and other erosive factors in the Kalut's basin has created a variety of them with different shapes and sizes. In some places, winds have filled the depression around the Kaluts with sand, and in other places, they have blown away the sand from around them. Now, let's take a look at the etymology of the word Kalut. Kalut is a blend of two words, Kal and Lut. Together, they mean the city of Lut. In the Khorasan region, in central Iran and along the coast of the Caspian Sea, the word Kal has taken on different meanings. In Khorasan and Sistan and Baluchistan, it's the root of words such as kalate and kalat, meaning castle or citadel. It could also mean a hamlet or a village perched on an elevation. In the center of Iran, the word kalat means a walled-off village. The Kaluts are an imaginary city. From a distance, they look like the remains of a ruined city. Of course, there are a few other areas like this in some parts of the world, but the Kaluts of Iran cover the largest such area in the world. Without human interference and technology, Mother Nature has put on display her unique artistic talent and creativity. It was starting to get dark when, on a nature trip, it's important that the nature traveler find the right spot where they can pitch their tent before the dark sets in. That will ensure a good night's rest without any trouble. I'm going to call it a day now, and I think the best place for me to camp out is right here next to a lone Kalut surrounded by sand. The wind has created this hole here as if to prepare it for someone to set up their tent in. This is perfect because here I'll have my back to the wind, which usually blows from the heights of Sirj Mountains back there towards the Kaluts. I mean, that's why this hole has been created. This Kalut hasn't allowed sand to accumulate here, hence the evenly shaped depression around it. It's just a perfect place to camp out. We're spending the night here. It's a great spot, and hopefully we're going to have a star-studded sky above us. Okay, I've been told I wouldn't be able to find any firewood or shrubs or any living creatures because deep in the heart of the Kaluts, the winds are so strong they won't allow any vegetation to grow on their path. In other words, if a plant grows here, it gets blown away by the wind. But there is an exception to that rule, and that is an area located on the path of floodwaters flowing down to the Kaluts area from the Ravar Mountains. The floods uproot the shrubs on the banks of the rivers nearby, the ones near the Kaluts, that is, and dump them in the seasonal river that's created near here and eventually brings them over to the Kaluts area. I might be able to find something there to make a fire here tonight to keep me and others warm. The temperatures in the Lut Desert fluctuate constantly, making life a bit difficult for nature travelers. Therefore, I always pack warm clothes and a good warm sleeping bag. Another beauty of the desert is its star-studded night sky. In the absence of light pollution, you get a clear view of the twinkling stars and part of the Milky Way. You can spend hours feasting your eyes on those beautiful celestial bodies that adorn the expansive firmament above. I'm glad I found these sticks. It gets really cold out here at night. I rarely make fire during my trips because I set a lot of store by nature and even dry sticks of wood. These sticks are a form of energy. They are no different than oil and gas, so we shouldn't use them recklessly. As I say, I don't make fire when I camp out unless I really have to. Most of the time, I don't need to. And when I do, I make a small one. But in the Lut Desert and in the Shahdad Desert, temperatures fluctuate a lot. I remember coming here 3 years ago. One night, winter was about to come to an end. I mean, like 2 or 3 days to the end of the season, 3 years ago. That night, right here in the Lut Desert, the temperature plunged to -1 degrees. Here's the thing. In the day, at midday, I mean, I had traveled deeper into this area and experienced temperatures as high as 43 degrees. That's a huge difference in one single day. It was all very strange to me. But well, that's what deserts are like. It's typical of them. It can get really cold during the night, especially during fall and winter. Therefore, you have to have proper clothes to wear. And if you manage to find a few sticks, you can keep yourself warm and enjoy yourself sitting around a campfire.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In truth, AFRICOM fights yesterday's wars tomorrow. As U.S. forces intensify local conflicts and militarism, they sow the seeds of future crises. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Jonathan N.G. Arthur. This article is published under the heading Covert U.S. Operations in Africa are sowing the seeds of future crises. Stay tuned for more. This March, Malian forces attacked Moura, a small sun-baked town in the middle of the country. The operation began on a market day, as locals streamed into the area with their livestock. Residents recall hearing helicopters slash the air and soldiers disembark with grim resolve. Malian forces laid siege to the village for multiple days, reportedly slaughtering civilians and wreathing corpses in flames. In a clinically worded communique, the government announced that army completed a systematic cleaning of the zone with very precise intelligence, killing 203 militants. Immediately, investigators contested its account, Human Rights Watch labeling the operation the worst atrocity in Mali's decade-long armed conflict. Estimates of civilian deaths range as high as 500. Another episode in a litany of atrocities. The United Nations has urged investigation of the latest scandal in Mali's war against militants. Yet the massacre also signifies the failure of the United States policy as Mali occupies the center of U.S. strategy in Sahel region. Since 2007, U.S. Africa Command, that is AFRICOM, has vigorously partnered with the states to combat militants, bolster influence, and check competitions there. Rather than secure peace, U.S. intervention has internationalized local conflicts, deepened social divisions, and fostered militarism. Its failure has profound roots. Malian crisis and other conflicts are inseparable from a cascading history of U.S. interventionism in Africa. African policy directly builds on the Cold War. After the Second World War, the U.S. discreetly promoted Western retrenchment in Africa. Officials helped Europeans reassert colonial mastery in order to forge a unified capitalist bloc and support for North Atlantic Treaty Organization. They notably armed France during its bitter war in Algeria, which became emblematic struggle for colonialism. But as the conflict drained Western legitimacy, U.S. policymakers encouraged Europeans to substitute informal hegemony for territorial occupation. Paradoxically, a new imperial order emerged with decolonization. Western capitals maintained effective sovereignty through a balance of soft and hard power. The haze of ideology, capital markets, political pressure, military bases, and other tools that could plunge a former colony into chaos. Lacking comparable tools in Africa, the U.S. initially outsourced imperialism to European allies. Yet gradually, the U.S. cast a searing shadow back in coups to smother radicalism, open markets, and combat influence. The Democratic Republic of Congo first felt its weight in 1960. U.S. officials regarded the country as a subterranean treasure trove brimming with strategic minerals. Yet they viewed its first prime minister, Patrice Lumumba, with acute anxiety. Lumumba refused to accept Western hegemony while celebrating Congolese independence as a decisive step towards the liberation of the entire African continent. President Dwight Eisenhower wished he would fall into a river full of crocodiles. That summer, he schemed to assassinate Lumumba and install a pliant substitute. The CIA deemed his removal an urgent and prime objective. Eventually, secessionists compelled Lumumba to request UN intervention. Yet, as the historian Elizabeth Schmidt observes, the operation was largely an American affair. The U.S. ferried UN troops to the Congo while snatching power from Lumumba. After he thwarted their grasp, the CIA helped local officials apprehend him. They handed Lumumba over to secessionists, who brutally murdered him before an approving audience of Western observers. Lumumba's assassination was a cruel premonition. In following years, U.S. leaders ruthlessly eliminated exponents of African liberation. They especially targeted Kwame Nkrumah, an elegant colossus of pan-Africanism. After Lumumba fell, Nkrumah warned that neocolonialism threatened to subvert African independence, reducing states to shells directed from outside. Nkrumah turned Ghana into a bastion of revolution, offering safe haven to anti-colonial movements and inspiring U.S. civil rights activists. In response, the U.S. State Department froze loans and depressed global prices, throttling Ghana's economy. Offices finally struck in February 1966. U.S. officials gloated that the new military government was almost pathetically pro-Western. In 1957, Ghana's liberation was the symbolic catalyst of African independence, lending decolonization an irresistible air of inevitability. By contrast, Nkrumah's downfall solidified an ominous trend toward military rule. Before 1965, coups were relatively rare. Within less than two decades, military leaders governed 40% of Africa. Ultimately, U.S. strategy curbed the promise of independence and accelerated the drift toward militarism, while carving the continent into invisible yet enduring spheres of influence. Repeatedly, U.S. partners waged catastrophic proxy wars across the region. Nkrumah's critique of neocolonialism proved prophetic. For those who practice it, it means power without responsibility, and for those who suffer from it, it means exploitation without redress. In 2020, the elaborate defense system imploded. That August, another U.S.-trained officer, Colonel Assimi Goïta, seized office in the Malian capital of Bamako, again citing the security crisis. His power grab initiated a wave of six groups in five countries within 2 years, immersing Mali, Chad, Guinea, Sudan, and Burkina Faso in chaos. AFRICOM had trained many of the plotters. In Guinea, local forces paused an exercise with U.S. Army Green Berets to storm the capital. Most coup leaders cited the threat of militants and poor governance, crises that AFRICOM had not solved but aggravated. Before 2001, U.S. officials registered no terrorist organizations in sub-Saharan Africa. By 2019, they tallied nearly 50. For years, AFRICOM had inflamed long-standing local conflicts, wrenching societies apart and lending militants meaning. And now, in a reverse domino effect, the very forces it enlisted to fight were rebelling. Tensions with Mali have compelled Western forces to scale back operations. This February, France announced troop withdrawals, while waning confidence in the West prompted local authorities to hire mercenaries. African Commander General Stephen Townsend warned that the decision would conclude in horrific violence against Africans. 2 weeks later, the Moro massacre unfolded. In the resulting fallout, Mali dissolved defense agreements with European allies this May while accusing France of espionage. The military junta then abandoned the G5 Sahel, prompting President Mohamed Bazoum of Niger to announce that the region's main security organization was dead. UN forces remain in Mali, sustaining heavy losses, investigating an exponential increase in human rights violations and defending an abrasive government that lacks control over the majority of its territory. Meanwhile, the UN warns that 18 million residents in the Sahel face severe hunger as war and famine sweep through the region. Yet the mounting crisis also implicates the U.S. AFRICOM regards itself as invisibly sleek and deadly effective, an elite force that fights tomorrow's wars today. But in practice, operations resemble previous neo-colonial interventions, fostering military rule and human rights violations. In truth, AFRICOM fights yesterday's wars tomorrow. As U.S. forces intensify local conflicts and militarism, they sow the seeds of future crises.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The following is the text of the speech delivered on June the 28th, 2022, by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the head of the judiciary branch and a number of the top officials and employees of the judiciary. First of all, in those days, the imposed war had created the worst, most difficult situation. The people stood firmly, imams stood firmly, like Mount Damavand, and the caring officials and the revolutionary youth stood firmly. They turned the situation around 180 degrees. They changed continuous defeat in the war into continuous victory. They cleared the munafiqeen from the streets. They helped the army and the IRGC to become more organized every day. And they returned the country to a normal situation. There is a point to pay attention to in this. When these events took place, whether it was the martyrdom of Shahid Beheshti or in subsequent events, the enemies rejoiced. They were hopeful that the foundations of the revolutionary system were falling apart. But they were frustrated in this hope. They were frustrated that day, and this frustration and disappointment has been repeated for them many times during these four decades.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today. And that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
At one time, the enemy hoped for something. It hoped for a weakness or for a shortcoming in the system of the Islamic Republic, but they were frustrated in this. This has happened many times. However, the problem of the enemy is that they cannot understand the secret behind their being frustrated. They cannot understand why this happens. What is the reason that the Islamic Republic can get up again from beneath all these pressures, stand firmly, and continue on its way? They do not understand this. They have not been able to understand that in this world, apart from political calculations and contingencies, there are other calculations and contingencies too. These are the divine traditions, which I will now describe in brief for you. These traditions are laws or rules. The Almighty God has put rules in the material world. He has rules and laws in the human world. The Holy Quran says, "And the sun runs on a term appointed for it." That is the ordinance of the mighty, the knowing. And as for the moon, we have ordained for it stages. The Holy Quran, Surah 36, verses 38 and 39. These are all laws. Neither is it allowed to the sun that it should overtake the moon. The Holy Quran, Surah 36, verse 40. These are current laws, and they are in front of our eyes.
You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio, with you every single moment.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
I'm heading with pro-Russian forces to the front line, just outside the city of Donetsk. We move at a fast pace, as there is constant incoming and outgoing at these positions. Suddenly we are told to run as we reach open ground. The pro-Russians have just fired a heavy artillery barrage. The Ukrainians will most likely respond in kind. We reach the trenches. Opposing them is the Ukrainian stronghold of Adievka. For 8 years, the Ukrainians have been digging in, creating a complex network of underground bunkers. It will be one of the greatest challenges for Russia in this war so far. This fighter is an Abkhazi volunteer from the south of Russia. I asked him why he came to fight in Donbass.
It's our common sacred task to stand by Russia. We understand that an unjust war is going on. This territory is Russian land. Unfortunately, NATO and the USA are trying to make use of the collapse of the USSR. And you see the results of this work. Unfortunately, people die in war. And Russians and Ukrainians are fraternal peoples.
Now, about a month ago, I was in a frontline position not far from here, and it was pretty quiet. Now, the situation has changed as the pro-Russian forces here are trying to move forward into different positions. The Russian army is far to the north of here. There's a feeling that before making a full push, they will wait for the Russian army to come down and help to encircle Adievka. But for the moment, they're trying to keep the Ukrainian positions occupied. That's why there's so much incoming and outgoing from this position. While NATO and Ukraine have been declaring for months that morale is low this side of the battle lines, all the pro-Russian fighters I've spoken to over 2 months here clearly have high morale. They're in no doubt they will take Adievka soon, as well as the rest of Donbass. And they believe they are fighting for a worthy cause.
They know perfectly well Russia doesn't target civilians, so they set up their positions where civilians are. We have sympathy for these civilians, but we will liberate them. And for those who force the Ukrainians to fight, for the Nazis, we do not have any sympathy. The card, as ever, was played by the Americans. It should be realized, Ukraine doesn't need this war. Their minds are not clear. They were left no choice but to fight by NATO.
While Ukraine is putting up a fierce defense in Donbass, the advantage is Russia's, with its overwhelming artillery superiority. As this conflict approaches its sixth month, soldiers are dying for each kilometer of land. Johnny Miller, Donbass.
Five rounds of voting by UK Conservative MPs have produced the final two candidates for party leader. It's now down to Tory party members to decide who will be the next leader of not just their own party, but the country too. The finalists, Rishi Sunak and Liz Truss, are lining up for their final showdown to become Boris Johnson's successor. The winner set to be announced on September the 5th, following a vote among the 160,000 or so members.
While members have been given a full month to vote, experience from past similar postal ballots suggests that many members will probably decide on who they want to vote for immediately, casting their ballots as soon as they get the chance to do so. So that means that the two candidates will have to rely on a rapid, hard-hitting initial start to their campaign in order to try and grab as many to their side as they possibly can.
The Conservative dogfight has raised concerns within Tory ranks that bitter divides are being exposed to the public, further damaging the party's overall image.
The comments made in the debates were really more
personal in nature and really relating to people's performance and particular minutiae of policy. There aren't really substantial differences in the Conservative Party. There may be slight disagreements on, well, you shouldn't have put the taxes up, or you should have originally been a Leaver, but now they're all signed up to taking Britain through the Brexit process, which, contrary to some, is still continuing because there's unfinished business from leaving the European Union. But really the differences are slight and have been somewhat exaggerated.
The two candidates must now travel across the country and tackle questions from members. With the economy in crisis, party reputation on the rocks, and even greater issues with foreign policy, whoever wins will have serious work to do. Robert Carter, London.
They can make people laugh, impersonate voices, or sing. The stage for talents. The 5th International Stage Stars Festival brought together participants from 14 countries, including Iran, Afghanistan, India, and Turkey, to get on stage and perform in Iran's city of Rafsanjan.
I come from Bangladesh. I have participated in the hosting section. It's an amazing festival for the likes of me who pursue their dreams.
I am participating from Iraq. I'm so glad to have the opportunity to show my talent here in this event.
I have to represent our culture, Indian culture, and when I was in the start in the Tehran, then how I managed to live because I didn't know the Persian language.
The contest has four categories of singing: stand-up comedy, show hosting, and sound impression. Contestants say this stage provides a shortcut to their success.
I'm so happy to be able to take part in this international talent contest. It provides a great opportunity for stage talents to be seen and shine in their favorite fields.
Stage Stars is a good chance for singers, sound impressionists, and stand-up comedians to be discovered. It's a big leg up for them.
The jury is comprised of top Iranian actors, TV presenters, and voice artists. They say only their real talents will be picked for the top prize.
This is a competition between the professionals of stage performance. There is no chance for a mistake. Each contestant here has a strong background in their expertise, so this stage is not the starting point, but a milestone for their careers.
One interesting part of this festival is the participation of international talents, who are mainly students from other countries who study in Iran. There's a separate competition dedicated for foreign participants.
All of the contestants, even those who come from foreign countries, must perform in Persian. However, organizers plan to include other languages in the upcoming editions of the festival. The top performances from each category will win the golden mic, plus a cash prize.
Organizers say this contest seeks to scout for those who really have a knack for stage performance and to bring them under the spotlight. So to those who nab the golden mic here, this stage is a springboard toward their ambitions. Yusuf Jalali from the city of Rafsanjan.
The European Commission is asking EU member states to reduce demand for gas by 15% until spring. For now, this is just a request, but the Commission warns it might well become a demand.
The 15% are aspirational. It's a voluntary goal. It's aspirational. And in case that